Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the HR Room Podcast. It's finally here. On the off chance you missed it, the new code of practice for employees' right to request flexible working and right to request remote working finally landed, meaning that employers and employees now have clarity on this topic, we think. But there's lots to unpick here and lots of things employers must be aware of. So to talk to us about this, we're delighted to be joined again by Jennifer Cashman, partner and head of employment at RDJ Solicitors. Thanks for joining us again, Jennifer. How are you?
Thanks for having me on. I'm very well. Thanks. Delighted to be here with yourself and Mary to discuss this important development for everybody.
Yeah, looking forward to the chat. And as always, we're joined by our very own Mary Cullen, founder and managing director here at Insight HR. How are you, Mary?
I'm great. Thanks, Owen. And brilliant to have you here again, Jennifer, to discuss this long-awaited code of practice. I thought it was meant to be out on the 31st of January, wasn't it? It got kicked out a little bit.
Yeah, they were keeping us in suspense, Mary, but we finally have it.
We do.
Brilliant. So let's jump right in and talk about it before, while we're, I suppose, been waiting long enough to talk about it. Let's jump right in. Brilliant. So Jennifer, look, to kick us off, it was a bit of a general question, a bit of a context set, a bit of an opener. What's included here? What does the new code of practice cover? Just a general, I suppose, intro to what's happened.
Of course, Owen. Yeah, thanks a million. So I suppose it's important to, set the legal context for all of this, just to remind ourselves. So we had the enactment of the Work-Life Balance and Miscellaneous Provisions Act of 2003. That was enacted on the 4th of April, 2023. And that act provides for certain employees with caring responsibilities to have the right to request flexible working arrangements from their employers. And it also provides for all employees to have the, subject to having completed certain service requirements, all employees to have the right to request remote working arrangements from their employers. Now, it's important to note the legislation provides for the right to request it, not the right to get it. But the legislation then, when it was enacted in 2023, also provided that a code of practice would be produced by the government that effectively the parts of the legislation that provide for the right to request flexible and remote working weren't commenced until that code of practice was published. So on the 6th of March last, the Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment approved the WRC code of practice on the right for employees and employers in terms of the right to request remote and flexible working. The part two and part three of the Work-Life Balance and Miscellaneous Provisions Act of 2023 were also commenced on that date. So now as and from the 6th of March 2024, employees now have a statutory right to request flexible working in certain arrangements and remote working arrangements, and employers have an obligation under the legislation to consider those requests. So I suppose the purpose then of the Code of Practice is to provide guidance for both employees and employers. For employees, it provides guidance on in what circumstances they can make their application to work flexibly or work remotely, and what they must include in those applications to do so. And for employers, it provides guidance on what must be considered by the employer when looking at requests for flexible and remote working, the kinds of criteria that employers should take into account when considering those requests, the basis upon which an employer might refuse those requests. It also sets out helpfully the kinds of issues that should be considered by employers to include in their policies and procedures. It also includes template application forms to work remotely and work flexibly. So it's a really useful document, Owen. It builds on what we have set out in the legislation as the right to request. And this document now is the document that sets out the basis upon which employees should make their application and the basis upon which employers should consider those applications. And I mean, look, you made reference to it at the start. We have been waiting a year for this document to be produced. But I do think, to be fair to the Workplace Relations Commission and the stakeholders, ICTU and IBEC, who were involved in inputting to the document, it is a document that has been worth waiting for. It is a comprehensive document, and it is actually quite helpful for employers in terms of considering requests and the kinds of issues that must be considered in dealing with those requests.
Definitely, and it's great to see. And I know at the first look I had at it, it did look, even visually, I thought this has a lot of stuff in here. So it's great to see it finally come to fruition. And I suppose it's just another simple, what might sound like a simple question, Jennifer, but just to confirm, but I'm right in saying it, this applies to everyone immediately, and all companies should be thinking about changing their policies for this straight away.
Absolutely, Owen. Yeah, and that's a good question, actually, because, you know, some pieces of legislation provide for different thresholds in companies before things take effect. This right doesn't, so it applies to all employers. Now, from an employee's perspective, whilst employees have the right to request flexible and remote working arrangements from day one of their employment, they must have completed 6 months continuous service before the arrangement actually kicks in. So there is that 6 month service requirement. And I suppose that's to tally with, usually organizations would provide for a 6 month probationary period in their contracts, or should provide for a 6 month probation period in their contracts of employment. So from that perspective, there is a provision that whilst employees can make their application from day one of their employment, they do have to have completed 6 months continuous service with their employer before if the arrangement is granted, before that arrangement can actually commence.
Brilliant. So Mary, Jennifer alluded to it there. It looks like a quite a decent fit for purpose code of practice. Anyone I had a look, I'd be inclined to agree as well. It looks quite solid. I suppose, Mary, what's the initial reaction been from employers? Has it been well received? Is it something people have been looking for support on? What's the initial kind of ear to the ground, I suppose, feedback you've heard yourself?
I think most companies have a position point, don't they, on remote and flexible working anyway. And, you know, for many employers, they might have full in office and we have no flexibility, or we have hybrid work arrangements or remote work arrangements. So most people post-pandemic have put in place a policy. I have noticed a trend over the last year of employers looking for people to come back in, and to come back in for 3 days a week or 2 days a week, or, you know, there being anchor days or that kind of approach to it. Which isn't proving all that popular when you actually talk to employees themselves. I think I mentioned already on the podcast, I'm in a gym, and every week, every single week without fail, people at that gym complain about having to go into the office. So I attend the gym on either a Tuesday or a Thursday and a Friday. And Tuesday and Thursday are core days for some people, and they complain bitterly every time. And it's really interesting because we hear from, you know, HR management, from frontline management, from CEOs who have a different position point on it, and certainly coming from the point of view that, you know, culture has suffered if we don't bring everybody back in, and at least for some days together, or we're not aligned in terms of our departments and certain departments, and people need to see each other more frequently, and those kind of things. But I think the code of practice at least brings clarity now to employers and employees. I do expect, once people become widely aware of this policy that a company will have to put in place, that they will get more requests, and people will look for more flexibility. And I think you will see that in particular for people with caring responsibilities, as well as those who are unhappy with current arrangements around their hybrid or in-office options at the moment. So I'm expecting to see quite a bit around that. There's not a lot being said out there at the moment. You know, we had just discussed that before we came on the podcast. You know, there's not a lot out there at the moment, but I do think it will gather momentum because I think the requests are going to start coming in, and there'll be challenges to that, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think I agree, Mary. And in terms of, I suppose, as a sort of a starting point for employers, because I think that's what employers kind of want to know, what do we have to do now as a starting point in light of the publication of the code. And I think the starting point is the policy piece that you mentioned. I mean, a lot of employers already have policies in place. They might be called remote working policies. They might be called hybrid working policies. Interestingly, you know, I've seen reference by some commentators to the code having a template policy. It doesn't, in fact, have a template policy. But what it does have very helpfully is it has a list of the headings that employers should include in their policies to take account of these rights to request flexible and remote working. And interestingly, the Code of Practice talks about developing what is referred to as a work-life balance policy. So I suppose as a starting point, I'd say to employers, if you have a policy that's called something else to deal with these rights, then you probably should be looking at amending it to reflect the suggested title by the Code of Practice, which is a work-life balance policy. And I suppose just on that point from a legal perspective, because sometimes we'll have employers asking us, well, what happens if I don't follow the code? What happens if I don't do what the code tells me to do or suggests that I do? And while the failure to follow a code of practice is not in and of itself an offence, both the Workplace Relations Act and the Work-Life Balance and Miscellaneous Provisions legislation itself provides that in any proceedings before a court, the Labour Court or the WRC, a code of practice shall be admissible in evidence. And any provision of the code which appears to the court, body or officer concerned to be relevant to any question arising in the proceedings shall be taken into account in determining that question. Now, what does that all mean? What that all means is that this code of practice has now become the best practice for considering applications for flexible and remote working. And if an employee is unhappy with the manner in which their application has been considered under the legislation, they can take a claim to the Workplace Relations Commission, the WRC, and the WRC will look at that claim in the context of this code of practice and determine, okay, did the employer comply with the code of practice? Did it handle the request for the employee in accordance with the provisions of the code of practice? So it is really important that employers take this code of practice into account because it will start to be relied upon from a legal perspective in Workplace Relations Commission claims. So that's the starting point, I think, for employers. Okay, let's take out our policy, which we may have in place since COVID or just thereafter. So let's take out our policy. Let's dust it down. Let's look at it. What's it called, first of all? Should we be, and I think you should be looking at changing the name to Work-Life Balance Policy. And then there's a list of headings in the Code of Practice that the code suggests employers should address in their policies. So have we all of those headings addressed in our policy? Have we given consideration? So things like role eligibility, employee eligibility, health and safety, working arrangements, flexibility, anchor on-site days, Mary, that you just mentioned there, that lots of employers will have their anchor days, working hours, working environment, setup costs and expenses, and who's going to be responsible for those, any taxation implications of the arrangement, jurisdictional issues, so whether the employer is going to allow working remotely abroad, and if so, what jurisdictions are allowed or not, a review clause to say that the policy can be reviewed, and then the issue of application forms. And as I say, whilst there isn't a template policy as such, just the headings, there are template application forms for remote and flexible working included with the code, and they should most certainly be looked at in comparison to the organisation's existing application forms to make sure that the application forms are in line with they don't have to be identical, but they should certainly contain at least the information that is contained in the template application forms provided for in the code.
I think a lot of employers haven't adjusted terms and conditions of employment either at this point. And it's one of the things that we hear regularly from our clients. Well, they're contractually obliged to attend the office. But you look at, well, you know, how long have they actually not been in attendance at the office? And I think a lot of employers kind of had a wishy-washy policy. We'd like you to come in for 2 days a week or 3 days a week, and found that actually people didn't come in, or they came in minimally or as little as they possibly could. But employers still holding on to that viewpoint that the terms and conditions of employment hadn't changed. So I would imagine with the formality that comes from a remote or a remote or flexible working request, will need that adjustment to the contract of employment or the terms and conditions of employment that you have in place. And it'll bring that formality. And I think that's needed from both an employer and an employee perspective, because there's this insecurity, I guess, from an employee perspective. Is my employer just going to say that's the end of that and bring us all back in? And I think people do have that fear, you know, that they might ultimately end up 5 days a week back in the office, which they don't necessarily want. And I think it also brings that clarity to employers from the point of view, it's time now that we update and we address these issues properly within the business.
Completely, Mary. And actually, the code helpfully sets out, while it sets out that there should be a provision in the employer's work-life balance policy about reviewing the policy, it also provides helpfully that employers may also build in a trial period or review of the flexible or remote working arrangements. And I think that's really important from an employer's perspective, to have that comfort that, you know, we can do it on a trial basis. We can keep it under review. If it's not working, we can look at changing it. The code sets out that, you know, that type of review, either a trial period or just a review of the arrangement, should be based on an existing clear job description, so that any conversation about performance refers to clear indicators on both sides, to understand what is expected from them. And it says day-to-day issues arising with the flexible or remote working arrangement should be raised and resolved informally, and there should be no surprises when the formal review meeting takes place at the end of a trial period. And then they provide some sample wording that an employer can include in terms of building in that review period. So that's really useful for employers, I think. But it also underpins exactly what you're saying, Mary. It's that, okay, whilst of course you can build in review and of course you can build in trial periods, there also needs to be certainty. And there needs to be certainty about a few things. There needs to be certainty about what is your job description, what is your role description, what are our expectations of you in that role, and if we agree to flexible and remote working arrangements, what are our expectations of you in relation to those flexible and remote working arrangements, and on what basis might we be talking to you to say that those expectations are not being met? So, and I suppose, you know, I've been saying this since after the pandemic. I think, you know, performance management and review of people's performance has actually been more positive since the pandemic, because employers have had to relook at it. And, you know, performance management is now suddenly no longer about how long are we spending in the office? Is the person in at 9 o'clock and are they still at their desk at 5:30? It's about actually what's their output? What's their actual output? What's their actual performance in their role? And I think that's a lot more positive, both from an employer's perspective and from an employee's perspective. But this code of practice underpins that exact certainty that you're talking about, Mary, that employers need to build in certainty as much as they can. And yes, whilst they can build in trial periods and review periods, there does need to be certainty about what the person's role actually is, what the arrangement that's been granted actually is, and what the expectations are of the employee during that arrangement. So I do think that's extremely important. I totally agree with you there, Mary.
And I think it's also interesting. I mean, it's one of the things we come across, both of us, Jennifer, we've talked about this before, about, you know, even just in probation periods, how employers and managers often don't have those informal discussions with people to say, I'm not happy with your performance. And I can see the same thing applying here. This remote or flexible working arrangement isn't working, but nobody is actually speaking to the employee about it, and hey presto, comes to a point and they go, no, done, it isn't working, I want you back in office. So again, it's important that your line managers are trained around the types of informal discussions that ought to be taking place in relation to any arrangements that are actually in place, so that we don't end up in the same situation where we regularly land when it comes to probation.
Definitely.
Yeah, 100%. Sorry, Owen.
No, I'm just going to say there's so much to talk about, and it's great. I knew this would be one of those ones where I didn't need to nudge you too much because there's so many things to unpick here. It's fantastic.
You can't actually get a word to bed.
Brilliant. That's brilliant. Makes my job very easy. But I suppose it's a great point you're both raising about that kind of employer-employee. There's a lot for both sides of the coin here. I suppose, Mary, one of the things that you kind of alluded to there, it's important for employers not to get sucked into the kind of housekeeping, updating the policy strictly, I suppose, just updating the written word. There's a lot of support and working with your employees is the kind of key thing here. And to be fair, that is referenced, I think, in the code as well. But that's an important point for employers to note, isn't it? I mean, we say with a lot of policies, but it's particularly important for this one. It's not to be a rubber stamp. Here's the rules and thanks and God bless, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and we always say that a well-crafted policy is key. You know, put it in front of your employee resource groups if you have one, if you're maybe large enough to do that, and talk to them about how this looks and how this works. Absolutely. But bringing a policy to life is key. This particular policy will matter to employees. It'll really matter to employees, maybe more than most other policies that we put in place. So you can expect that your employees are going to be watching out for this. And once it's in place, certainly once you introduce it into your organization and update your own policies and procedures, those requests are going to come. You can expect it. And it's really important that we have a clear position point from a management perspective about how we're going to handle this, because I expect those requests to come through. And when people don't get what they want, and we've seen this for years anyway in HR, and I'm sure in employment law, Jennifer, when people don't get what they want, they raise grievances, they make issues, conflict can develop within the workplace, and ultimately people can go out to the WRC if they're not satisfied. It doesn't necessarily matter whether you've been reasonable or not, or whether there's any logic or not to people's claims. Sometimes people just bring them anyway because they haven't got what they want and they feel that they're right. So I think you just have to have a clear position point and, you know, come at any request from a reasonable perspective. The questions that are outlined, I think, are really useful in the code of practice. And I think they're really going to be helpful from an employer perspective, you know, both to grant those requests and to refuse them. So they're well worth reading.
Absolutely. I know, and this might be a good time for us to talk about actually that application process, because I know that employers will be very interested in this. And this is where the code, I think, really comes into its own in terms of setting out what must be included in applications, what might be included in applications, what the employer must consider in handling the application, and what the employer might consider in handling the application. So there are some differences. So if we look at, and they're slightly different for both flexible and remote working. I suppose the flexible working application process, as we mentioned at the beginning, flexible work applications are only available to certain employees. So they're employees that are in caring, have caring responsibilities to either a child or another person. So in terms of an employee wanting to make a flexible working request, what the code says that they must submit their application as soon as practicable, but no later than 8 weeks before they want to start the new arrangement. Now, as I said, if they don't have 6 months continuous service, they're going to have to wait until they do have 6 months continuous service to start the arrangement. They can apply for it from day one, but they will have to wait that 6 months if they haven't got the continuous service. If they do, then they must apply at least 8 weeks in advance of wanting to start the arrangement. It must be in writing. It must be signed by the employee, although the code does provide for electronic applications to be acceptable from that perspective. And a lot of employers, if not most employers, will probably have an electronic arrangement set up whereby employees can apply. And then a request for flexible working must include the following information: the form of flexible working that's requested, because obviously flexible working can take a number of different forms. It can be compressed hours, it can be part-time working, it can be term time working, it can be remote working is a type of flexible working. So there are different types of flexible working and they're set out in the code. So it must set out the form of flexible working that's required, the proposed starting date and the proposed duration of the working arrangement. So that's what must be included. And then employees are encouraged to include the following information: details of whom the request for their flexible working for caring purposes relates. So is it a child or is it another individual as set out in the legislation? In the case of a child, a copy of their birth cert or a certificate for placement for registered adoption agency or TUSLA. And in the case of another person under the legislation that isn't a child who is in need of significant care or support for a serious medical reason, the employee should state their relationship to that person and the nature of the significant care or support that the person is required and relevant evidence of that. Now, the relevant evidence could be a medical certificate or it could be such other evidence as the employer may reasonably require. Now, what the code also sets out here, and it's very important to mention it, is that both employees and employers have to be mindful of their GDPR data protection obligations, because obviously that type of information that an employer can reasonably require in terms of medical certificates or other evidence is naturally going to include some sensitive or special categories of data, as it's now referred to under GDPR. And employers need to be mindful of their obligations from a GDPR perspective in terms of storing that type of documentation, retention of that documentation. So again, here we go now with cross-checking our work-life balance policy against our data retention policy, our data privacy policy. How are we handling that information? How are we storing it? Have we got special systems in place to store it? Do only people who absolutely need to have access to that information have access to it, and making sure that, you know, it's not generally available. And then in terms of a remote working arrangement, then It must be signed by the employee or an application made online. It must include the following. So details of the remote working arrangement that's requested. So how many days, which days, the proposed starting and end date of the arrangement. And again, that 6 months period is relevant here. And the reason for requesting remote working. Now that's interesting. So why is the employee requesting it? So they actually have to set out a reason why they're requesting remote working, not just because they want it, but they have to set out a reason. Now, the code does set out some examples of the reasons that employees can use. So it sets out, now it's a non-exhaustive list. So employees can say that they want to reduce their commute and carbon footprint. They want to optimize their quality of life outside normal working hours. Their personal or domestic circumstances are such that they require a remote working arrangement, or neurodiversity or special medical needs or circumstances which could favour a quiet working environment or facilities not always available in the office. Now, that last point, of course, brings up employment quality issues. It brings up potential occupational medical reviews from the employer's perspective, reasonable accommodation of the employee. But of course, employers need input from occupational health in order to be able to consider what reasonable accommodation might be applicable if somebody is suffering from what would be considered a disability under the employment equality legislation. So that's a little bit of a trickier area for employers, but it is provided for also in the code. And again, the application must also include the details of the proposed remote working location. So is it from home? Is it from a working hub? The information on the suitability of that location. So that's really helpful now for employers, because here we go with employers who are very concerned for a while with, look, somebody's asking me if they can work from home, but I'm not sure if they have a setup at home. I'm not sure if they're sitting on the side of their bed with their laptop. I don't want them in that position, and I'm concerned about my health and safety obligations as an employer. So the application must include information on the suitability of the proposed location. And then the code sets out information which the employee should include. So they don't have to include it, but they should include it. So again, things like that the workstation is suitably encrypted and configured, that the workstation provides adequate privacy, a commitment to ensuring the company data and intellectual property will be protected in accordance with the existing employer policies, an agreement to complying with the employee's own obligations under health and safety legislation, an agreement to a risk assessment so that the employer can risk assess the workstation to make sure that it's suitable, an agreement to demonstrate compliance with data protection, confidentiality, social media, the availability of relevant equipment and technology, confirmation of adequate and secure internet connection. They're all really useful factors that employers have been, to be fair to them, quite concerned about, and understandably so and justifiably so. that, you know, to make sure that their data is protected and that employees are working in a secure and private work environment. So employees are being encouraged to include all of that information in their application forms, which means that employers, when crafting their application forms, can also provide for all of those factors in their applications. So I think that's really helpful for both employers, to be fair, and employees, so that everybody needs to sit down and think about, okay, well, I'd like to work remotely, but actually, can I work remotely? Do I actually have the tools and facilities available to me to work remotely? So I think that's really helpful because it makes everybody stop and think about the application that's actually being made. So I do think the code has been very helpful from that perspective in setting out those factors. So that's the application process. So that's the kinds of things that need to be thought about in terms of the application process and the application forms and the policy around that. Will we move on, Owen, to factors to be considered then by the employer? Because this is the piece that employers were really keen to understand, what flexibility would they have in terms of the factors that they could consider when looking at applications for remote and flexible working.
Absolutely. That was going to be my next question. So you're preempting it perfectly, Jennifer. Yeah, roll on.
Okay. So I suppose, okay, let's look at what the employer must consider under the legislation. So they must consider their own needs. So that's the business needs, the employee's needs. So the reasons for the employer requesting their remote or flexible working arrangement and the requirements of the code then in relation to considering a request. Now, can I just say here that the code divides right to request flexible working in one section and right to request remote working in another section. But in the section dealing with flexible working arrangements, it sets out that in considering a request for flexible working, an employer can take into account the factors to be considered in requesting in dealing with a request for remote working. So it's the same factors that employers can take into account in both sets of applications, which I think is really useful because I think there was a fear amongst us as practitioners, amongst HR practitioners, and also amongst employers, that there might be different sets of considerations, but there isn't. The code sets out that you must consider your statutory obligations, which is the business needs, the employee needs, and the requirements of the code. And then the code sets out that obviously employers should consider their applications in an objective, fair, and reasonable manner. So that's really important. The code very, very helpfully, in my view, sets out a list of non-exhaustive factors that an employer can consider when looking at an application for flexible or remote working. And the kinds of things that an employer can look at are the type of work that the role entails. And this is where we come back to that piece that Mary and myself were discussing earlier on about having a clear job description. So let's understand what the employee actually does on a day-to-day basis, not what their role title is as such, but what they actually do on a day-to-day basis. What are the employee's key duties? And they can change, obviously, maybe on different days of the week, which then you'd be back to, well, maybe they could be out, maybe they could work remotely on a Monday, but I really need them in on a Tuesday because of what their role entails. Can any of the duties which make up the role be undertaken remotely? And remember, there are some roles that can't be undertaken remotely. And that's fine, as long as an employer can stand over that. Does the role require a high degree of manual work? Does the role include tasks that must be performed are more efficiently performed on site? Does the role require access to equipment or technologies or data that are only available on site? Does the role require face-to-face engagement with clients, customers, or other employees on site or at other locations? Would remote working affect the service quality or organizational operations, considering the number of employees currently on approved leave and or on approved remote working or flexible working arrangements? You can take into account the number of other people that are on those arrangements. Are there technological solutions to mitigate issues arising from remote working? So can the employer think about other IT solutions? And do any health and safety issues arise if activities are undertaken remotely? So again, they're really useful things that an employer, and I think employers will be relieved to see those being included as factors they can take into account. And then when they're considering a request for remote working, they can also consider the suitability of the employee themselves for the arrangement. Again, really helpful, because not everybody necessarily is suitable for a remote or flexible working arrangement. And again, it's a non-exhaustive list. So does the employee have the necessary IT skills to complete the job specifications remotely or flexible? Does the employee understand their role and require minimal supervision in order to complete their tasks? And that might be, you know, seniority might come into play there, that a more senior employee might be suitable, maybe a more junior employee might need more. And then, of course, the whole point of that is you might need the senior employee on site to help to mentor the junior employee. So that might be a reason why you might be able to grant the request. Has the employee met performance standards and requirement of the role? So are they on a performance management plan, for example? Is the employee subject to an extended probationary period, which might mean that you could say that now again, there's, as Mary mentioned earlier, there are issues around probation and limits on how long you can extend people's probation for, and the circumstances in which you can extend probation under our transparent and predictable working regulations, which were introduced in 2022. But, you know, there can be circumstances, limited circumstances, where an employer does extend a probation period. And that's a factor that can be taken into account. Is the employee involved in an ongoing disciplinary process, or is there a live record of a disciplinary issue that can be taken into account? Is the employee subject to a training program? Have they demonstrated an ability to meet deadlines or other business requirements? Do they understand the need to demonstrate flexibility? So we're giving you flexibility, but we also need flexibility from you. Do you understand that it's a two-way street? When required to attend on-site business arrangements, do they understand that they will need to require they will be required sometimes to attend on-site? Does the employee understand there may be a requirement to sit in team meetings, training, or one-to-ones online when they're working remotely? Have they maintained a satisfactory attendance record? Have they complied with the company's attendance policy? Do they need to be on-site for learning or training? And do they need to be on-site to collaborate with colleagues in a team environment in a face-to-face setting? So all really helpful factors that an employer can take into account. And they're all of the factors that, as Mary has mentioned earlier, that employers have been talking to us about in terms of their concerns about remote and flexible working arrangements. So they're all the things that an employer can take into account, but they must be taken into account in an objective, fair, and reasonable manner. So when you know, there can't be subjectivity involved in this, it must be objective, it must be fair, it must be reasonable. So again, it's back to the why. Why can't I do it? If you're refusing my request, then why are you refusing my request? And you've got the list of factors there that you can that you can take into account. And I really think that's really, really helpful from an employer's perspective.
100%. And I think just before I kind of jump back to both of you for your kind of final thoughts and advice, I suppose, Mary, when this whole topic, I suppose, kind of hit the headlines a couple of years ago, there was a lot of coverage of the kind of 13 reasons why, and any Netflix watchers will, that'll be sound familiar to them as well for a different reason. But there was the optics around that, Mary, were a little bit kind of compliant, and it was, yes, you'll have this right, but here's why we can say no. But I think by the sounds of it, Mary, judging by everything Jennifer's saying and by looking at the code itself, we seem to have gone to a much more logical, impartial, kind of practical space, I think, where this has landed. Would I be right in saying that, Mary?
I agree. I think so. And I do think those questions are very useful and will allow employers to consider and genuinely consider those requests coming in. But, you know, in real terms, when we speak to, you know, our HR colleagues and our employers or our clients, you know, often they are looking for ways to say no. And because it doesn't suit for whatever reason. And I've said before on this podcast, and we talked before we kicked off the recording today, you know, I know numerous CEOs who have been uncomfortable with the kind of remote and flexible working arrangements that arose post-pandemic, and have always wanted people back in office. And I think that that exists at a certain level. I think over time it will change, you know, as the next generation of CEOs who are used to much more flexibility, much more work-life balance, take on those positions and roles. But I do think also in the code of practice, we do have to note that in situations where an employer cannot approve, having gone through this process of reviewing an application, but where they can't approve the arrangement because it doesn't work for whatever reason it might be, whether there's more collaboration. And collaboration is the thing I hear most from our clients as being important to a business. In situations where they can't approve it, the code does say that the party should consider an alternative arrangement where that's feasible. And the employer should be open to exploring that and agreeing that alternative arrangement, where feasible, of course, being the key word there, taking the specific circumstances of the individual into consideration. And so that kind of opens another little bit of a door as well, doesn't it, Jennifer? Because now we have decided, no, what you have asked for doesn't work. And that might be where someone says, look, for work-life balance reasons, I want to relocate away from this urban area. I'm going to buy a house in the countryside somewhere where it's cheaper. I'm going to build, or I'm going to do something like that. This makes more sense for my life. But, you know, that means I don't want to be in the office 3 days a week or 5 days a week. Could I have a fully remote working arrangement and put that in writing? The employer looks at it and says, no, it doesn't work for us. Then they need to maybe come back and explore, well, is there something I can do here? Is there some way I can work with you to come up with an alternative? And that might be around start times, for instance, to miss rush hour. It could be all sorts of things that an employer might consider as a way to look at considering something else. But where feasible is key. But I do think it's a bit of a backdoor. You said no to this, but now could I have this as well? I can't have that, but could I have this arrangement? And I think there could be a bit of argy-bargy here where you're back and forth around what else? What else could I have if I can't have this?
Yeah, 100%, Marianne. And I agree with you. I think it's back to that, I suppose, objectivity, isn't it? Piece that an employer can't just say no, the kind of blanket no, that they have to be seen to actually give it consideration. And I suppose that's all part of that, okay, you've looked for, say, for example, as you said, a fully remote arrangement. I can't give you a fully remote arrangement, but I could have you working remotely on Wednesdays and Thursdays or Wednesdays and Fridays or whatever. So yeah, I agree with you. I think there is very much a sort of a social policy message here, which is that, you know, where possible, we're favouring this idea that employees should be facilitated with these arrangements where it's possible to facilitate them. And employers must really go very far in considering those applications and giving them the real sense of objectivity and be very transparent about the reasons they say no and consider whether there's an alternative. There's one really important issue, Owen, if you don't mind, that I'd just like to highlight in respect to the code. And that's the whole, because I know it's something that Mary and I would have discussed previously, that employers were concerned about that whole idea of, well, what can an employee do if they're not happy with my handling of their request under the code. And what the code provides for that, obviously there are situations where an employee feels that their request has not been handled in line with the code, and that they can then take a complaint or make a complaint for alleged breach of the Act. The legislation to the Workplace Relations Commission, the WRC, and they can be referred within the usual timeline of 6 months of the date of the alleged breach by the employer, or 12 months for reasonable cause. Now, the interesting thing that the code sets out very clearly is that under the Act, neither an adjudication officer nor the Labour Court has the legal power to assess the merits of any decision by an employer in relation to a remote working or flexible working application. So in other words, they can't look behind the merits of the decision to grant it or refuse it. They can only look at the process which led to the employee's decision. But I suppose that underpins the fact that in looking at that process, employers must be able to show that they've considered all of the things outlined from the code. And exactly as Mary has said, the code does provide, if you can't give one thing, then you should consider whether you can give another thing. So an employer should be able to demonstrate that they have gone through that process and that they have taken all of the factors outlined in the code into effect. But I imagine we'll see a little bit of argy-bargy in the case law about that as well. The fact that what the employee is really trying to address is the fact that their application has been refused, not necessarily that the employer hasn't gone through the application process. So it will be very important, I think, for employees to understand that their remedy is not, well, the employer said no, and therefore you can take a claim against them. The remedy is the employer has said no and has not considered your application in accordance with the provisions of the legislation and the code of practice. And that's a slightly different thing.
100%. And I suppose perfect segue to that final question, I suppose, for any kind of final thoughts and advice, and I'll come back to yourself, Jennifer, first, if that's all right. I suppose, as you said, it probably won't be all kind of unicorns and rainbows. It won't all be, I suppose, rosy in the garden, but I suppose where possible, and I suppose generally, Jennifer, if there's that approach of objectivity with a little bit of flexibility, I suppose, coincidentally enough, that's probably where the sweet spot will be for the employer-employee kind of relationship, won't it?
Guarantee that objectivity piece, the fact that, look, we have looked at your application properly. It's not just a blanket no. You know, we are obliged to look at your application properly. We have considered it properly. We've taken all of those factors. We've taken all of those factors into account. And I think from that perspective, you know, the factors that I was talking about earlier, things like the number of other people who are on remote and flexible working arrangements. Well, that means that, you know, by design, then they can't be indefinite arrangements, because if you give somebody an indefinite arrangement, that might impact on somebody else's ability to be granted a remote or flexible working arrangement. So that provides then, I suppose, for an employer like that to put maybe a defined time period on the arrangement, following which it'll be reviewed, so that at least then if you had a situation where you had too many people or enough people doing one arrangement, at least you knew they were coming off the arrangement. And then we'll consider your request again when we have a slot for you, basically. So I suppose it does allow employers to exercise a degree of flexibility in terms of the arrangements, and that you know, I suppose, underpins the fact that those arrangements aren't necessarily forever, that they can be time-limited arrangements so that everybody in the organisation gets a fair stab at the application process. So as I say, Owen, I think the important thing for employers is a starting point, take out the policy. Let's look at the policy. Is our policy called a work-life balance policy? If it's not, should we look at changing the name? I think you probably should, so that you can sort of demonstrate to the WRC that you have that policy that's provided for under the code. Have we considered and included all of the things that are provided for in the suggested clauses set out in the code of practice? And does our application process take into account all of the factors that the code allows us to take into account? So I really do think that this code is helpful for employers. And I think it'll be useful to employers when considering requests.
100%. That's what kind of final word to yourself then, Mary. I assume you'll probably be echoing a lot of Jennifer's thoughts as you have throughout the conversation. But I suppose with Mary, again, there's lots to think about here, but there is some kind of core fundamentals about how you do things as well. And I know for our frequent podcast listeners, they know they've heard that before, but it is an important thing to consider with stuff like this, Mary, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you have to think about it. So you have an application form, someone puts in the application, it's assessed by who and in what way. We've got to be practical about it. And then we have to think about how we communicate those decisions to employees. So do we leave this as a desk-based exercise? Do we build in meetings with employees to discuss this? Do we decide we're not going to do that? Do we, I do think it'll need to be linked to your grievance procedure. And many of those policies aren't at the current time, those pre-existing policies, because I think you're going to want to try and capture these issues internally before people go out to the WRC. And always your paper trail is key. So making sure that your decisions are documented, they're clearly documented, whether you decide you don't want meetings or you do want meetings or you do want appeals or you don't want appeals. These are all decisions that you as an employer, you in HR are going to have to build into your policy document. And, you know, but remember, and we always say this, and we say, Jennifer, I'm sure you echo the same thing, your paper trail is key. If you find yourself in the WRC trying to prove that you took a reasonable, objective and fair approach to an application, and you're trying to prove that you had a fair process in place, your paper trail is what does that for you. So whatever your policy document looks like, reach out. There are people out there that can help you, like us, like Jennifer. And these things need to be carefully considered. How do they link to our GDPR policies? How do they link to our grievance procedures? What do we do around appeals? Do we have appeals? Do we not? all of that has to be factored into your policy now, as opposed to the docs where we just have out, we now are operating a hybrid arrangement and we want you here for this amount of time. I think those days might be gone. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. I'll be keeping a keen eye on it. And I'm sure, Jennifer, you'll be bringing the first of whatever case law comes. I'm sure you'll be quick to the draw to talk about it, as you always are.
We'll be back. We'll be back on our podcast again, Mary, to discuss the first case that's taken to the WRC under the for sure. Yeah, we've just recently had the first case held against an employer under the Sick Leave Act. So you know, that's taken a little bit of time to work through. It's taken 12 months to work through. I'm sure it'll be the same here. But I look forward to our podcast, Mary and Owen, when we have the first case under this code of practice and the legislation before the WRC.
Brilliant.
So and then we'll all change our policies again, Jennifer.
No doubt, Mary. No doubt. They're living, breathing documents.
They are.
Perfect. And look, so great to get that kind of advice, clarity, and a bit of a review on the code. I know people were waiting for it for a long time. And I'm sure they'll be delighted to get such a great chat about it too. So I hope everyone enjoyed that episode. And thank you, Mary and Jennifer, for a very practical, useful discussion, as expected. Didn't take much work from my end. Great to get so much detail into that one episode. So thank you very much for that. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll catch you next week for the next installment of our podcast. So don't forget to click subscribe and join the discussion on our social media channels. If you are enjoying these episodes, do please feel free to share them with colleagues, friends, and family. And even better, if you can leave us a review on whatever platform you're on, we'd really appreciate that too. And as always, for HR consultancy services and management you can trust, get in touch with us today at insidehr.ie. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Mary.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Jennifer. It was great to have you on.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.